You're listening to Trucking Questions from the Audio Road with Kevin Rutherford. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. You can ask questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, tax, technology, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the Audio Road.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. If you've got questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, you name it, we'll talk about it here on the air. All you have to do is pick up the phone and join us. We're going to get to those calls in just a little bit. A couple things I want to talk about. You know, lately, last several months, I've been talking about making slight improvements every day and doing it in any area of your life that you want to make better, whether it's your relationships, your money, your health, your business, whatever it might be. The thing that I've learned after reading literally thousands of books about how to improve in all those areas is that most of us try too hard for too short of a period of time, and we don't see the results we're hoping for, and we tend to give up and go back to our old way, and we don't give ourselves enough time, one, to build the habit, and two, to really see the results. And if you can get that concept, it really makes a big difference. So I started working on this a couple months ago, and I've been telling you about it. So now I am on the road for the first time since last July. And this road trip I thought was going to be a little challenging. For one, Lisa's already been gone a month. She's on the East Coast. I've got Diesel with me. So that's a new challenge. And we've got a lot going on at work. So I was wondering how the new habits are going to hold up. And granted, it's only the first day, starting the second day now. But I can see that by developing those habits over the last couple of months, it is so much easier. You know, I just didn't know if while I was on the road, I would be able to maintain the same things that I was doing every day at home. And I spent enough time getting set up and preparing that I can see that I can do this. Now, I've had to give up a lot of things, but you know what? It doesn't feel like I'm giving things up. In fact, I like it much better. I talked quite a bit over the weekend about giving up Facebook, just not really spending any time online anymore. And the other thing that I realized was that I'm not watching any TV. I never used to watch a lot of TV, and then I got kind of into that habit of, you know, just relaxing every night and watching TV. And there's nothing wrong with relaxing, and there's nothing wrong with watching TV, but it was becoming a habit, and I just don't have time for it with all the new habits. And honestly, I like the new habits better. I don't feel like I've given anything up. But I went back and kind of thought through the last 2 months. I've only watched 3 hours of TV. Well, the last 30 days, I guess Lisa's been gone about a month, a little more. I've only watched 3 hours of TV since she's been gone. And they were three recorded hours, a couple shows I wanted to catch. So I got thinking about my schedule on the road and all the things I need to get done. You know, 3 days a week, we need to record 2 hours. 2 days a week, I have 3 hours live, and those aren't times I can move. I mean, those are kind of set in stone, and I have to work around those. And for the most part, they're kind of in the middle of the day, depending on what time zone I'm in, which is going to be another challenge, is as I work my way east, my schedule will change every time I get in a new time zone, because again, I don't have any flexibility with the show times. I got looking at the schedule. I got to do the shows. I got to work and run the company just like I always do, which means emails, conference calls, writing, just all kinds of stuff there. I need to maintain this new lifestyle that I like so much. And I've actually dropped about, since I started, about 30 pounds. And I wasn't really what you would consider overweight before I started. My body fat is now down under, the last time I checked, 13%, and I'm working on getting under 10. And I've been doing some weight training again, so actually my body weight will start coming up. It already has a little bit. The eating was one of the challenges that I know is always something you face when you're on the road and you're trying to eat healthy. And I was excited about the new ways, some of the new things that I'm doing as far as eating and getting out on the road and seeing, could I maintain those on the road? Now, granted, I have a little more space in the RV, kitchen-wise, but everything I'm looking at doing, I could do in a truck. It would be a little more difficult. I'd have to do it on a slightly smaller scale. But so far, I could see that all of this stuff could be done on the truck. Takes time. That's really the key. You know, space is an issue, but if we put enough thought and effort into it, we can overcome space issues. I'm doing that now, and I could do it in an even smaller space if I needed to. It's time, I think, that everybody feels like they don't have enough of. But I've said many, many times, instead of focusing on the negative aspects of trucking, which a lot of people do, a lot of people love driving, they love being in trucking, but they focus on the negative aspects. You're away from home. I get that. I drove a million miles. I know what it's like to be away from home. Lisa and I have been apart for a little over a month now, and it's probably going to be a couple more weeks. I have several things I have to do before I actually make it to Ohio, probably. In fact, I don't think I'll make it to Ohio. I'm going to end up meeting Lisa in Louisville probably just a day or two before the truck show starts. So looking at, you know, the day and saying, you know, if I'm going to be away from home, which is a challenge sometimes, if I'm away from my family, which I know you all deal with, instead of making that a negative, how do we make it a positive? And one of the ways is, you know, I'm away from the demands of home as well. Now, I have a lot to take care of on the RV. These things are, you know, there's always something going on with these. Electrical, plumbing, they're very complicated systems. I've already had to fix two plumbing leaks starting out on this trip. A couple of electrical issues. But other than that, I'm away from the demands of home. My friends aren't, you know, constantly coming over and, you know, wanting to spend time, or, you know, there's always something going on around the house. Now that I'm kind of by myself, Diesel and I'm on the road, I looked at the clock and I said, okay, there's 24 hours in a day. Now, for me, I've got it worked out that I can only drive 6 of those. There are a couple days where I'll be able to put in more. Monday and Tuesday, when I kind of consider those days off and we don't do the shows, you know, I could do the 10, 11, 12 hours a day driving if I need to. But the 5 work days, my goal will be to get in 6 hours of work and 6 hours of driving. Now, that's equal to your driving time and break time and pre-trip time. 12 hours will cover that. You know, most days, you're probably not putting in all 11 hours. But even if you are, throw in another hour. So my schedule will be very similar to yours, except mine will be broken up 6 hours of driving, 6 hours of work to run the company and do the show. That leaves 12 hours. That's a lot of time. Now, since I've changed my lifestyle so drastically in good ways, I find, and this is just me, everybody's going to be different. I went through a lot of issues on sleep. I studied a lot of stuff on sleep. And most nights, I'm only needing about 4 to 5 hours of sleep. Then what will happen, and I just kind of listen to my body, usually once a week, I kind of feel it catching up to me, and I'll need to do a 6 or 7 hour night. Now, I don't feel horrible. I actually feel much better than I have in a long time on 4 to 5 hours of sleep, and I have tons of energy. Then once in a while, when my body says, hey, getting a little wore out, I'll do a night of 6 or 7 hours. And I'll usually try to time that so it's one of the days off and I don't lose a lot of time anyway. So 12 hours working, let's call it 6 hours sleeping. Because there, you know, you may not be able to do 4 or 5, but I'll tell you, if you get in better shape, more healthy, you might be surprised. But let's call it 6. 12 hours of work and 6 hours of sleep, and that's 18 hours. We have 6 hours left. That's a lot of time. I mean, I can get up, work on some food prep stuff on the road, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. Some exercise with Diesel. We'll go walk, we'll go run, we'll go ride the bike. He'll come with me. I'll come back. I'll do a little weight training. And nothing elaborate. I've got a set of adjustable dumbbells with me, something you could carry in the truck. And all of that might take 2 hours. And that might include some yoga some days even. So we still have 4 hours left. The food prep might take an hour or so. We're down to 3. I get some reading in. And it's a full day. No TV, nothing online, but I haven't been healthier and more energetic in a long time. So stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. A couple more minutes. We're going to get right to some phone calls. I want to tell you one of the things I've been working on in doing it mostly at home and then hoping it was going to translate onto the road so that it's something I can help you out with if you're interested in this. Two things that have made eating on the road so much easier, and I can see how I will be able to sustain this. And the first one, and this is so good for your health, I've talked about fermenting or culturing vegetables. It's a real simple process. You can go look it up online. In the beginning, it might look confusing because everybody does it a little different. But the good news is, no matter which method you pick, they all seem to work. I've tried a bunch of them. Mine is drop dead simple. The way you culture vegetables, and it creates probiotics and it makes the vegetables actually healthier than raw, and it preserves them for long periods of time so you can keep better than fresh vegetables on the truck with you, which was always my challenge on the road, even with an RV and a kitchen. Getting into a grocery store, you know, I'm just as long as you are. So getting into some of the better grocery stores that I like to shop at and get good organic produce is challenging sometimes on the road. Now, I won't need to. I literally, in a fairly small space in the refrigerator, have about a month's worth of cultured vegetables. If I eat a lot of them, I could still make it 2 or 3 weeks easy. And to culture them is really simple. Again, you can go look online for some of this stuff, but you put them in a brine and you leave them out on the counter for, this is another thing, usually a minimum of 4 days. But I know people that leave them for months and months. That's why you can keep these in the truck without refrigeration if you want. Now, they will continue to culture, and the flavors will get stronger over time, and the vegetables will get softer. But I've got some that have been out for over 3 weeks now, and they're actually getting better. I usually do mine 4 days. I throw them in the refrigerator, and then I usually eat them, and they're gone. But I've been experimenting. I've got some out that are coming up on a month, and they're still doing really well. So it's simple. The brine, drop dead easy. A quart of filtered water. So I just use a quart mason jar. I put a quart of filtered water in there, 2 tablespoons of mineral salt, pink salt, gray salt, sea salt. Just don't use table salt. Use a good mineral salt. And that's it. Quart of water, 2 tablespoons of salt. Pack your vegetables into mason jars, pour in the brine, cover them up, stick them on the counter. Now I use airlocks on the top of mine, which make it easier. But if you don't have airlocks, you just have to open the container each day, let a little bit of air out because they'll build up pressure. That's it. And now I've got all these vegetables in the refrigerator, and whenever I want them, they're there. They're better than raw. The other thing I do, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, I pre-cook my protein every couple days, every 3 or 4 days. If I'm going to get out the stuff to cook, I'll just do a whole chicken. I'll do, you know, a couple pounds of beef, or I'll do some salmon, and it'll be enough for 3 or 4 days. Then when I want to stop and eat, grab some mixed greens, grab some of the protein, some of the cultured vegetables, I've got a meal and off I go. So we talk a lot more about that on Kim's show every Friday. She's been letting me join her and talk about all this stuff. So you can always check that out. It's called Destination Health. You can find it on the website, letstruck.com. Let's get to some phone calls. Let's head off to Texas. Sean, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I listened to your show on Friday with Kim. It was awesome. I actually bought some Pevita probiotic on the way home.
Isn't that stuff amazing?
Well, I don't like to sell vinegar, so I had to throw away. I bought like four different bottles, and since I hate the smell of vinegar, I had to like try each one to see which one I like the best. And the lemon raspberry was pretty good.
Yeah, you know, Lisa's a lot like that. She is really turned off by anything that's even slightly vinegary. That's why the kombuchas won't work for her at all, because they're very vinegary. The Kevita,
I'll hold my nose and drink it down if I have to.
Well, you know, and the Kevita, if you play around with the flavors, it seems to me like anything that says coconut in it, like the mango coconut, the pineapple coconut, they don't seem to be as acidic. Now, there's something called drinking vinegars, and I actually try those once in a while and kind of like them. So, of the probiotic drink, those are clearly the most mild.
Yeah, they're a great show. Now, I almost fell out of my truck when you talked about leasing a cow. I sure hope you get yourself a free emission cow and you do sampling on it.
Oh, we did. You know, okay. I've got the whole history of the cow, and you know, and it's not a lease purchase, by the way. This is just
okay,
a straight
good.
Yeah.
Okay, because I don't want the bank to take it away from you before you get your milk. You know,
that's right.
I was concerned about that. So, but yeah. I wanted to report my 60-day fuel economy on my fleet air filter on my Freightliner Cascadia.
Oh yeah, how's it doing?
Well, I did the first 30 days, and I talked to you a month ago. I was up 0.7 miles per gallon, and now I'm about roughly 0.2. But if you look at my numbers, my fuel economy has been erratic. It's been snowing ice down here in Texas. I've been pulling a lot of odd loads just because it's slow right now. So my average speed went like 52 to some runs. I was doing 65 to 875 miles an hour. It's just this crazy run. But even all said and done, I'm still up over the last 60 days. And I'm predicting in 90 days, I'm still going to be over 0.4.
That is pretty common. That is probably the best results. I mean, we always get good results from a fleet air filter, but the Cascadia filter seems to be producing the best results overall, which really tells me two things. I know they put a lot of time and effort into engineering that filter, but it also tells me that the Cascadia stock must be really restricted as far as airflow.
It is. I mean, I work for Prime, and I've been with them since day one, and I run a dedicated position in Central Texas, so I really can, every lane, like I'm on one lane that I run about 5 times a week, so I know every hill, and, you know, I know all the fuel, but I have one of the oldest Cascadias in the fleet. When we switched to the 14 Evolution, I think the airflow on the Evolution must be a little bit better, especially with the single turbo setup they have now to the compound. But it seems like their airflow is a little bit better, but still restricted at the airbox. You know, I have to imagine the turbo's working a little bit better, but it's I got a friend of mine that's about to order his fleet air, and he has a 14 Evolution. So we're going to be tracking his numbers. I've got him signed up on fuel gauges. So he'll have a before and after, too. So he's going to wait 60 days, do his numbers. Then he's going to get the fleet air filter, and then he can report that, too. So, it's very awesome. If anyone hasn't got one, they need to get it. I've already paid mine off in 60 days.
Yeah, that is fantastic. And this is a good time because I'm hoping, I talked about how tight my schedule is going to be for the next couple of weeks on the road. I've got a lot of stuff I want to get done. I'm hoping, though, that I have some time before Louisville to stop into Fleet Air Filter. They're down in Mobile, Alabama. So I'm heading down I-5 now, and I will hit pick up 10 or 40. I'm not sure yet. Start heading east, depending on the weather. It's been a while since I've been across 10. I might take that route. And as long as I have enough time, I'll stay south and hopefully get to Fleet Air Filters for a couple days before Louisville. If not, we'll head down there after Louisville. But with Mid-America coming up, that is a great time. They always take filters with them. They have them at the show. They usually have a show special. We'll be talking about that this weekend. So great timing. Let's head off to Kentucky. Adam, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How are you doing?
Good. What's on your mind today?
I had two questions for you. The first one is yesterday I was driving up to Marion, Ohio, and all of a sudden I used my Jake brakes, and all of a sudden my truck just started shaking and acting all kinds of funny. So I pulled over on the shoulder, and I made sure I didn't have any water in my fuel filter, checked my breather. I got a TS performance box on here. I unplugged it, make sure that wasn't a problem, and it was still doing it. I ended up unplugging my Jake brakes, and it did it for a little while. I drove down the road. I got about 5 miles and everything straightened up. So I was like, okay, I don't know what I did because I did a bunch of stuff at one time.
Right.
So I plugged my Jake brakes back in. Everything worked good until I let, and then it all started all over again. I hear the music there. You want me to wait?
Yeah, let's go ahead and get to a break, and I'll come back and we'll talk about that. You did a great job of troubleshooting, by the way. Try some things, get it fixed. Figured out you might have tried too many, do one at a time. That's a great way to troubleshoot. That really helps a lot, whether I'll have an answer for you or not. But even when you get to a shop, when you can tell them all those things, that's going to help a lot. So stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to get right back to Adam. So, Adam, it sounds like you've clearly identified the fact that this is a Jake brake issue. There are several things that can go wrong on a Jake brake that would cause this. When was the last time this engine had an overhead?
It's been before I bought. I've had a truck about 8 months. So I'm planning on doing it. March 20th is when I'm planning on getting that done.
Well, the good news is you might want to do it sooner because you need to get into the top end anyway. We've got to get in there and find out what's going on with the Jakes. They may need rebuild. It may just be a problem we can fix without rebuilding them. But what it sounds like is when the Jakes activate, basically what they're doing is leaving the exhaust valves open. And what that does is turn your truck into a giant compressor and bleed off all that compression, and that's what slows the truck down. Rather than keep those exhaust valves closed, which creates the compression and drives the piston back down, even though we don't have any fuel, that's what keeps the truck rolling more free. But if we open those valves, bleed off all that pressure, that's what slows the truck down. Well,
okay,
if it sounds like we might not be getting a valve closed back all the way when the jakes activate, or we've got something going on there. So the good news is it's due for an overhead. Get it in, get the jakes looked at, get the overhead done while you're in there, and knock out two things at once.
Okay. Okay. That's what I was thinking, is maybe when them exhaust valves are hanging open, you know.
Sounds
I'll get that done.
You know, the vibration is probably coming from the fact that it's only one cylinder hanging up. We're not opening. So that's what it sounds like we've got going on. Oh, wait a minute. I think you had another question. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. The other one is an aerodynamic question. I got two options, and I don't know which way to go. It's a 377 Peterbilt 2000 model, and I got one stack passenger side. And right now, I've got my trailer gap really close. I mean, when I turn, I got about 3 inches between the cab.
Good.
So my question is do I leave the stack where it's at and have the exhaust blow in the airstream, but I know that it's got drag from the wind? Or do I open up my trailer gap another foot to allow room to put the exhaust in the back and get that airflow off of it from the side?
Yeah, that's a tough question, because when it comes to aerodynamics, nothing is consistent. You know, this is the opposite of rolling resistance. Rolling resistance, I don't care what the truck is. I mean, it is the same all the time. When we drop 10 points, the results are almost always the same. Aerodynamics are the exact opposite. Every truck is a little different. The truck trailer combination is a little different. And the changes we make are really tough to predict sometimes. We do know that if we get something like an exhaust stack out of the airstream, we make an improvement. How much of an improvement? I don't know. And most of the time, when we move the exhaust, we're also affecting back pressure on the engine at the same time. And we usually try to make sure it's a positive effect. So when we're going to move exhaust, we try to make sure that we get it as straight as we can, as short as we can, keep the bends out of it. If we have to do a bend, we'd rather do 245s instead of 190. So it's really, really tough to predict.
It's going to be like a trial and error thing. You know, if it don't work, move it back.
Possibly. And the other option, do you idle a lot?
I am right now. Yes, sir.
Okay, then we don't want to do a weed burner. I was going to say, if you don't need to idle, weed burners are actually about the best exhaust we can build. The least number of bends, shortest distance. But if you idle, wouldn't recommend them at all. Let's go to Texas. Wayne, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I talked to you about 10 days ago about a design for a different type of trailer. I just wonder if you'd had time to think any more about it since we talked.
No, and I don't see myself working on projects like that anytime soon. You heard my open. I've got my days scheduled, you know, just about down to the minute. And I had to give up some things just to get everything fit in. So, you know, we've got Louisville coming up in just a couple of weeks. Then we've got...
What's your general opinion of it? Does it make any sense at all to you or not?
It does. It does. I was really intrigued. It was the first time, you know, even though I put a lot of thought into designing some trailers, that was the first time, you know, an idea like that came up. And really, the only thing I would want to spend time on, when I get a good idea or somebody brings me a good idea, this certainly wasn't mine, it was yours. When I see a good idea or maybe I come up with one, there's two things we have to look at. One, cost. You know, can we make this cost effective? And then we have to try to think of the downsides or the unintended consequences. those are always the toughest things to predict. You know, you look at, will this work? Will this work? Will this work? And you look at it, you go, yeah, this will all work. It's harder to predict what isn't going to work. It's harder to predict the unintended consequences. And then the next real challenge is engineering and actually getting this stuff to work on the road. Now, you're talking about a fairly, I don't want to say a complicated design, because, you know, there's already examples of this kind of stuff on the road. I'm in an RV that's got three big slide outs. You know, they make RVs now that are literally one giant slide out. You know, the whole bus is 45 feet long. Slide out's got to be 35 feet. It's so big. And it's got all kinds of weight in it. And they make that work. Hydraulics are pretty amazing. But you have to remember, they also have decades. I mean, I think we got our first slide outs in RVs in the late 80s. So they've had decades perfecting that kind of stuff. I've even seen really what seems to be a really simple product. And when you put it on the road and start using it, it is amazing how many things go wrong and how many times you have to re-engineer the product. So I think it's a great idea. And just to kind of remind everybody, you're talking about, instead of a slide out on an RV going sideways, you're talking about a trailer where we could change the trailer height based on the load. You have an operation where you pull very low loads most of the time, but you would want that flexibility of loading something taller. So your thought was a trailer that expands up. Now, the good news is trailer walls themselves aren't that heavy. They're pretty darn light. I mean, we don't put a lot of, you know, weight, especially if we're not talking about something like a reefer. We don't have to worry about getting it, you know, really insulated or anything like that. So we don't need a lot of lift to make this happen. And most of the components probably already exist or something very close to them. So I think it's feasible. And I think in the long run, I mean, we keep trailers 15, 20 years, no problem. I'm a big proponent of keeping trailers a long time. So that also gives a lot of time to recover the cost. So I think you're onto something. Finding a partner or finding somebody to create and engineer this is going to be difficult. When I just went to trailer companies with my signature trailer idea, and look, I wasn't doing anything new. Our first trailer, everything we put on that trailer already existed in the market. All I wanted to do was build it that way at the factory so we didn't have to spend all the money modifying it after the fact. And I went through all the major trailer manufacturers. Nobody wanted to talk to me. Luckily, we found, you know, Conway Manufacturing, which I didn't even really know they existed till we started this project. And they were willing to do it. And they might be willing to take on an idea like this trailer. They're pretty forward thinking. And the CEO over there, Lynn Reinbolt, said, "You've got an idea, bring it to me. We'll take a look at it."
What I'm concerned about mainly is if I talk to too many people and put too much out there, somebody will have it and I'll be out in the cold. You know what I mean?
And I'm not saying that couldn't happen, but let me minimize your fears. And I don't mean to take anything away from your idea. I think it's a brilliant idea. I didn't think of it, but ideas are a dime a dozen. I've heard so many ideas over the years. The problem is just what I talked about. Taking that idea from an idea to a finished engineered product ready to sell happens about 1 in 100,000 ideas. It might even be 1 in 1,000,000 ideas that actually makes it to production. So I don't worry too much about, you know, ideas getting out there and somebody else going to do it, because there just aren't that many people that are willing to do what it takes to bring that idea to market. If you're willing and you want to get started on it, I'll help you out as much as I can. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment, so I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. We're going to head off to Kentucky. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Mr. Rutherford. How are you today?
Good. What can I help you with?
Well, I was just curious. I missed the Sunday show, and I was, for one, curious what you found with what new thing you found with the signature truck, and I had a truck, if you could take a gander at it for me.
Got it. All right. So let's talk about the signature truck. We had a good show on Sunday. We literally got Jeff and Kathy on the air. They're the owners of the truck. We had Bruce Mallinson on from Pittsburgh Power. We had Jack Bro, which is the service manager at Pittsburgh Power. And then we had somebody that I had to keep referring to as Mr. Engineer. And it was kind of funny because he is actually an engineer with Detroit, and they have a policy about going on the air without tons of pre-approval and all kinds of other stuff. And so he came on and gave us some engineering background on this, but we couldn't really identify who he was. We just had to keep calling him Mr. Engineer. So we don't know for sure what happened. I know a lot more now, and I have a guess, but I don't know that it's going to do us a lot of good. We're going to learn a lot from this, but here's what I think happened. Early on, 24,000 miles into this, they had some overheating issues. The truck got hot on a climb, didn't shut down like it should have. We're not sure why not, but they caught it. They pulled over, let it cool down, took it easy after that, made sure they went up. You know, that thing was putting out some serious horsepower. Made sure they went up the hills easy after that, got it back into Pittsburgh Power. For some reason, Pittsburgh Power thought it was the Evans coolant. They're not a big fan of it. And that's one of those issues that, you know, they mostly do because I like the product and I haven't seen any problems with it. We've cranked up temperatures. We've done all kinds of things. But they thought, let's just get it out and see if that was the issue. Well, it would still overheat on a hard pull. Even after the Evans was out. But what they said was, if you pulled over, it would cool down faster. But we still had some overheating issues. My belief is when that truck overheated the first time, we did some damage to the cylinders. I think we scored one of the cylinders at that point and we lost compression. And that was why we were chasing the fuel mileage right from the beginning, because it was increasing. We got up to right around 9, and then we had the overheating, and then we were fighting fuel mileage after that. They dropped back down into the 8s, and there was a couple things that happened, and I am not blaming anybody. Kathy and Jeff were doing what they needed to do. Their truck, they were frustrated with the fuel mileage. I get it. They found another mechanic, and they started playing around with some settings. The ECM was changed 3 times. And we have no idea what the flash might have been on the ECM, what program they put in. And the turbo was changed 3 times. And at one point, they were down to a very, very small turbo that increased performance. They liked the way it drove, but it hurt fuel mileage. And that makes total sense. We go to bigger turbos to allow more airflow. But with a bigger turbo, you'll get better fuel economy, but the turbo will spool up slower. Your throttle response, you'll lose a little bit, and there's always a balancing act there. So then we started to see, you know, the problems that they're dealing with now, some of the corrosion, some of the pitting. The engineer looked at the pictures and said, it looks like detonation, you know, that at some point the timing got advanced too far on this engine. So now we're trying to second guess when did what damage happen. I believe that the problem started in that first 24,000 miles with the overheating, and then most of the other damage either was a result of some of that or was also compounded by, you know, somebody got the timing too far advanced. it looks like that was some of the issues, that the small turbo and advanced timing just kept adding to the damage. The corrosion, we're not really sure where that came from. So there was a lot going on in that engine, a lot of bad stuff, unfortunately. And, you know, it wasn't back at Pittsburgh Power. So now we're dealing with two different shops. And I'm in the middle trying to make sure that we're not just doing a bunch of finger pointing to try to lay blame on somebody, that we're actually going to fix this and learn something from it. So the good news is Jeff and Kathy are great sports about this. They've been very patient. The game plan is now get that engine put back together, run it pretty stock in the beginning. You know, we're not going to do any special tune on it. We're going to go back to the standard turbo, I think they said. And we're just going to run it for a while and make sure everything's okay, and then go back and go after the fuel mileage again. So it's definitely, I'm learning a lot. I learned a lot, you know, with the engineers and some of the other people we've gotten involved. I've also got Craig over at MicroBlue looking at the parts and figuring out, you know, if he can see anything different, because he's got a tremendous background in racing where they build crazy performance engines, run them once and tear them all back apart again. So, you know, that's not something we want to do in trucking, but it's good experience when you're looking at, you know, what might have gone wrong. So we'll keep everybody updated, but that's where we are right now. And our goal is really just to get Jeff and Kathy back on the road making money.
Well, all righty then. I'm glad I at least got to talk to you about that. And there's a truck that I'm looking at that I've seen sitting in the same place for a couple years now, and I know that probably that's going to cause some issues of itself. But this wasn't exactly a truck I was going to bite and put out on the road in less than a week anyway. It's a 93 Ford LTL A9000 that looked like it used to be an old Allied van line truck based on the color and the graphics on it.
Okay.
And it's got an M14 with a 13-speed and 342s.
All right. So the LTL is not the cab over, right?
No, the cab over was a CL. The LTL was the long nose, and the LTL-A was the Aeromax.
Okay, so I had a 95 Aeromax that I bought brand new with a 12.7 in it and ran it like 1.3 million miles, never touched that thing. Now, I'll tell you this. It's not my favorite truck for the cab quality. The cab quality actually was horrible. But I kept it for a million plus miles, and I drove those a lot, and I had a team in it, and you kind of get used to it. But road noise was loud. The doors sound like they're metal on metal when they close. Just that kind of stuff, the fit and finish on them wasn't good when they were brand new. So, but again, if I'm looking for a cheap truck to get into the industry or to make money with, I can put up with that kind of stuff. As far as sitting, you know, my experience is that the problems we see sitting aren't nearly as bad as what they used to be. Now, this is a 93. It's an older truck. And I think every year our components get better, our materials get better, and we're not seeing those same problems. But there's still some things you're going to want to do to this truck if you get it. It doesn't sound like you have any idea how much they want for this or if it's running or anything, right?
$9,000 is what they're asking. It does run. It does go into gear and everything else like that. It's just the way they have it advertised on truck paper. It just, the wording that they use has, at least in my opinion, the opportunity to scare some people off.
Well, the first thing that scares me off is the price. That's too high. For a 93 Ford, that's too high. If this were a really clean 93 Kenworth, then I'd be interested. A 93 Ford, honestly, I think I'd have to top out at about $6,000.
I was thinking five. I go in there with five and go with that.
Five would be better. 5 would be better. 6 is where I'd top out. $1,000 here or there isn't going to kill us when we're getting started, but I like 5 better. And I just absolutely don't think I would ever go over 6. But this could be a great truck to get started. I was just talking about N14s over the weekend, that the N14 is the one engine we're not running into part issues with. So Bruce and I are getting ready to design some N14 rebuilds and start building some gliders with those, just because we can get away with all these part issues we're dealing with. Hey, I'm looking at the clock. The music's playing. I've got to get out of here. We'll see you back here next time. Check out the website. It's letstruck.com. Remember, be safe, be profitable, do the hard work, and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, don't hang up. We're going to come back and do another hour here. We made it through that hour okay. My automation wasn't as good as I wanted. I had some weird things going on, but I think I got everything I needed. So let's go ahead and do another one. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. If you've got questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, you name it, we'll tackle it here on the air. In fact, if you've got any question at all, bring it to the table. I'll do my best to answer it. If I don't have an answer for you, many times one of our listeners does. No matter what the question is, we'll wrap it around that trucking lifestyle, which I am happy to say I am back out on the road myself again. I haven't been on the road since last June after the CMC, but I'm out on the road now. We'll be out here till probably June, so several months, and I'm looking forward to it. If you happen to be out on the road, I'll kind of give you my schedule. Now, I talked about my details of my schedule on the last show. I'm not going to go into that kind of detail right now, but I'm driving about 6 hours a day, working about 6 hours a day, so I'm not getting anywhere in a hurry. And I've got several stops along the way. So it's going to take me every bit of the 14 or 15 days to get from where I am now to Louisville in time for the truck show. But I left the gorge, the Columbia River Gorge, late yesterday, drove down to Seven Feathers on I-5 in southern Oregon. I'm sure anybody running I-5 is familiar with this place. What a great, great stop. This is always my first destination when I leave the house and head south. Great truck stop, great rest area, nice RV park here. So I pulled in here late last night and I'm getting some work done. Actually, by the time you hear this, I'll be someplace else. But I'm heading down I-5. I'm going to catch, I'll probably head over to Barstow from I-5 and then start heading on 40. And I'm trying to decide if I'm going to stay on 40 or if I'm going to drop down to 10 pretty early. If I have time, one of my stops will be in Mobile, Alabama to stop and see Fleet Air Filters. And then head up north to Louisville. So if you're out and about and you're running around, that's where I'm going to be over the next several weeks, either I-5, then 40 and 10, and then, I don't know, maybe 65 up north. Not sure yet. So let's get to some phone calls today. Let's start off in Arizona. Alex, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing today, man?
Good. What's on your mind?
Two quick comments and one question. You said a couple weeks back about when you got into the health kick, either people are going to love it or they're going to hate it. And I think the people that hate it acknowledge there's a problem, just don't really feel they have the time to deal with it. But I like the direction you're heading in. I follow you religiously, and I think you're doing a good job. So I appreciate
it. Well, thanks. Thanks. And I just want to throw in one thing, and that is that when I'm wrong, I've found that it's just a whole lot better to just admit you're wrong and fix it and move on. And I was really wrong about the eating issue. And it was because I didn't read enough. And I think that this might happen to a lot of people. And what I'm really talking about is what our calories should be made up of every day, our macronutrients, the kind of the big picture. And we've been through the Atkins, the Rosedale, the Miami Beach, where they were pushing low carb. And the thing is, most people assume that if you cut out the carbs, you were replacing it with protein. And that never made a whole lot of sense to me. And I tried it and absolutely hated it. I had no energy. I had headaches every day. And I said, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. But I didn't do enough research. I didn't read why it was supposed to be this way. And I didn't realize that it wasn't protein you were supposed to replace the carbs with. It was fats. But we've been so brainwashed into believing fats are the enemy and fats are what make us fat. And that seems logical.
But that's what we need to burn to get energy.
It is. And that's the piece that I was missing, is that once you get your body to burn fat as energy, and the only way to do it is to cut back on the sugars and the starches. And when you cut back enough on those and get enough fats, your body will start burning it, and the changes are amazing. I don't want to sound like a fanatic about this stuff, because that's an easy way to turn people off, but it's hard not to. You know, I go way, way back with nutrition and weight loss, wrestling my whole life. If I would have known this stuff, I would have been so much better, because I am so much stronger this way and I have so much more energy, and the fat is just dropping off without me being hungry, without me trying. In fact, most days I've been so active that at the end of the day, I actually have to go eat calories because I was losing too much weight. At the end of the day, I would have to look at all my numbers and go, I need to eat another meal. And I'd be fine if I didn't, but I need to eat another meal because I need about 400 or 500 more calories today. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, it's a great position to be in.
It is. I love it.
Well, I can tell you the worst thing about cooking on the truck, you got more space in the RV, but the worst thing about cooking in the truck is doing the dishes afterwards.
No question. And I have an advantage there. I don't have a big kitchen or a big sink, but I have a sink and running water. And that does make a big difference. But, you know, the trees and the environment are just going to have to suffer a little. I use paper and plastic as much as possible. And the other thing that I found is I get the soapy water ready before I even start cooking. And as soon as I use something, I put it right in the water, wash it. Because if I wait till afterwards, then I don't feel like doing it. Yep. That's just one little thing that's helped me.
Yeah. I was going to get back on Facebook. I've been off of it for a year, but I kept kicking like, I got to get on there and follow Kevin. Thought I was missing so much, but now that you're off of it, I have no motivation to get back on there.
I'm not going back. You know, I don't want to use the word never, but I can't see anything anytime in the near future that would convince me to go back.
Gotcha. My question is pretty quick and simple. I've got one of those trucks you don't like. I've got an ISX 15, 2012 Kenworth, Eaton Fuller 13-speed transmission, and 342 gears. I wanted to know what speed I should be running at to optimize that.
You know, your best bet is really, you know, the real key is always slower is better. Even speed even trumps RPM. RPM does have an effect on fuel economy, but most engines today, we could run them in a range from about the ISX, we can run anywhere from, say, 1275, 1300 when we're not putting a heavy load on it, all the way up to even 1600 at times and not suffer a lot in fuel economy. But when we change speed, the fuel economy is going to change much faster. Your best bet is going to be as slow as you can get away with in 12th gear. 55 to 60 in 12th gear is going to be a great range. With the 342s, you might struggle a little bit at 55 if you're heavy. That's something you're just going to have to play around with and watch, you know, if you've got a scan gauge or an instant read gauge.
I do. I run I-10 basically between Phoenix and Los Angeles.
That's good.
But I never noticed how not flat that is. I always thought it was pretty flat until I got the scan gauge. And it changes so fast, I didn't know what to do with it. I normally am running about 60 miles an hour, and it sits me right at about 1250 RPMs. And I've been doing pretty good there, but that's in 13th, yeah.
Try 12th and just play around. Yeah, because that's why 55 to 60 and 12th, 60 and above, probably 13th, but you might, and this is where you got to play around with it. You have three factors that can change what gear you should be in at any time at that speed, because you're right on the borderline. You know, if you're at 57, I could tell you 12th is going to be better every time. But at 60, you're right on the borderline. And the three factors that will change on you: weight, wind, and road surface. And road surface was something I used to talk about because I read it in my research that the road surface could affect the rolling resistance by as much as 30%. And I thought, wow, that seems crazy, until I started watching my scan gauge and nothing else would change and my fuel mileage would just drop. And then I would start paying attention to the road surface. You get on nice, smooth, polished concrete, fuel mileage goes up like crazy. Get on that rough chip and seal blacktop stuff, and it will drop like crazy. So the music's playing. Let me get to a break, and I'll come back, and we'll give you some ideas, some things to play around with. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. I'm going to get right back to the phone calls. I'm going to head back to Alex. So, Alex, play around with 12th. I think you may find it, and like you said, sometimes it just takes time. You're going to have to watch it for several miles and then pay attention. Is there a slight grade in there? Is the wind changing some? But what I like to try to do, and especially if you run the same run over and over, the same route, is I like to pick maybe a 5 mile stretch. One day run that stretch in 12th, the next day come back, run it in 13th, you know, do it a couple times so we can account for different weather and then average them out. And sometimes it's really obvious. Sometimes you drop the gear, fuel economy jumps right up, stays there. Other times it's so all over the board that it takes you, you know, a week or so to work out some good numbers. But my guess is that 12th is going to do better most of the time at that speed.
Gotcha. The, because I've been following the scan gauge pretty closely, and I have my little 5 mile stretch. It's pretty flat both directions, whether I'm heading east or west. But even with that, the wind has been changing and been very erratic over the past 2 months.
Yeah.
So I'm never sure. And then, like you said, we can run that ISX up to 1600. That's news to me. I don't like taking anything up past 15. So,
you know, we kind
of run it there safely.
Oh, see, safety isn't an issue. I'll talk about that in a second. What we're really concerned about is fuel economy. And, you know, my 12.7 Detroits, I can run them up over 1500, 1550 and not see fuel economy drop off much at all. Sometimes actually see it improve. It's something you really got to play around with. But let's talk about safety. These engines will run 2,000 RPM all day and never hurt anything. They'll run 2,200 RPM and not hurt anything. If you start getting above that, you run some danger. But there are diesel engines out there that'll run a 2,500, the smaller ones. 2,000 on one of these is no big deal. They'll do that all day long and not damage anything.
Yeah, that's amazing news to me. I was trying to play around with 12, but when it kicked it up over, you know, 1600 or in that area, I was just like,
yeah. Now, just so everybody's clear, because every time I make statements like that, when I used to be on Facebook, within about 30 seconds, somebody would be on Facebook going, that idiot said you should be running your ISX at 2000 RPMs all day. No, that's not what I said. I said, you could do it. It won't hurt anything. And I'll tell you, when I do let engines run up that high, 18, 19, 2000 is when I'm using the Jake brake. It's three times more effective. At that RPM, I mean, it'll hold you back on just about any hill. And it won't hurt anything. So let's just call 2000 the upper limit. There's really, we could go beyond that, but let's call 2000 the upper limit. And let's call 1600 probably the upper limit for fuel economy. And that doesn't mean we should be there all the time, but it means we could play around between 12 and 16, and especially with the scan gauge, learn more and more about fuel economy and what works and not worry about doing any kind of damage. Let's head off to Texas this time. JW, welcome to the program.
Well, I'll be doggone. Hello, Kevin. JW Penny Stacker here.
What's up today?
Checking in from Fort Worth, Texas, I'm checking in from. Wanted to invite you to join the Fairtex Now caravan to Louisville. I'm here in Fort Worth, Texas, getting my sleeper remodeled, and looks like they should be done in another week or so. So feel free to join the Fairtex Now caravan to Louisville from here.
Just be heading through there just about that time. So we'll stay in touch and see what happens.
Well, that'd be good. It would be great to spend an hour or a day with you on the road, and you and I could get some things straightened out. Doggone. I think you've run off the road here with this health and wellness track you're on, and I think I need to straighten you out. You got some good intentions, but I don't think you've read the book Eat to Live. And
oh, I have.
I have read
so much reading. And here's the problem, and I talked about this on Kim's show in detail.
I disagree, but
but everybody disagrees. The entire medical community, every author, everybody with an opinion on this disagrees. That's the whole problem.
There's about eight or 10 different doctors that are within, a couple paragraphs of being on the same page. Primarily, the majority of the ones that have got it right are plant-based. And you're in a different place right now than I am. And you push my buttons and get me all fired up every time you go off. But
let me tell you what, let me just talk
you're
here.
Telling, all right.
Let me. Just talk, because there's no consensus. Because I can find 8 or 10 of the top doctors who say plant-based is okay. It's not going to hurt you. You got to be careful. It can be a little more complicated, a little more difficult. It's not going to hurt you, but it may not be the best way to eat. And I can find a lot of really good doctors who will say The human body does just fine on meats, saturated fats, all of those things, if it's done right, if the quality of the fats and the meats are right. And that is the hard part. But forget what everybody says, because there's no consensus. These every doctor has their own opinion. There's all these different camps. But let me tell you what how I came to my solution. I spent 3.5 years as a vegetarian, strict vegetarian, not a vegan, but a strict vegetarian. No meat, no living animal of any kind. And after that, I went to seafood only. If it came out of the water, I would eat it. And I did that for about another 1.5 years. And I can tell you a couple things. I lost no weight. I actually gained weight. I felt like I lost muscle mass. I wish I would have measured it back then, but I absolutely know I lost strength. And I felt good. No question about it. That's why I say you can't hurt yourself doing that. But this time I thought, and I've tried the Atkins. It was a disaster because I think I was doing it wrong. Right now I'm following what's basically the Rosedale and Mercola, and there's 6 other doctors I could say that. And my results are what are telling me. And I'm just not talking about how I feel. I am measuring.
I understand you're getting phenomenal results, but
I'm also measuring everything.
You're giving advice to people that sit behind the wheel and don't do anything.
But I'm not telling them to do that. I'm not telling any. I'm not giving anybody any advice. I clearly
listening.
Said at the beginning of the show, don't take my advice. Do you remember me saying that?
Your idea behind fat. Let's talk about fat for a minute. And bear in mind, I am a student of this stuff. I by no means have read as many books as you, but I know enough, and I've listened to Dr. Furman and his Eat to Live book enough to learn. And if you consume fat, most of it is stored as fat on your body. Your body your body will only utilize, or it'll only actually burn 3% of the fat you consume as a mechanical means of getting it into your body. Yes,
that
we
is...
burn fat. Yes, we burn fat for fuel, but our stored fat is our primary energy source.
No, it's not. That's
not.
When you've trained your body to live on carbohydrates. That's the problem. The typical American diet is 50% carbohydrates. And as long as the body has access to carbohydrates, it will never burn the fat as energy. So you're right. It'll get stored. That's where everybody gets screwed up. Get your carbohydrate consumption down under 25%, and your body will burn fat like there is no tomorrow. It is an amazing change that happens when you get that carbohydrate load down. But carbohydrates are easier to burn. So your body will always default to them if they're there.
If your body is consuming carbohydrates, it takes approximately 25% calories to burn the carbohydrates.
I am currently at about 60% fat in my diet, 25% carbohydrate, and the rest basically in protein and some simple sugars, very, very few. And my body fat is lower than it was when I was wrestling and cutting weight like crazy. And now my body fat is lower. Now, you know, here's the thing. I fought against this one for years. I thought people were idiots. You got to be crazy eating.
Have you had your cardiovascular system checked with ultrasound and so forth to see how much fat and cholesterol you have in your arterial or veins and so forth?
My cholesterol is really, really low. I haven't checked it with ultrasound. I've done it with blood tests, but there's lots and lots of research that says cholesterol has nothing to do with heart disease. That's the other myth. We assume that cholesterol has something to do with heart disease. It's not true. There's lots of research showing. Hey, the music's playing. I'm going to come back. You know what, JW? I'm not. We're going to have to talk about this on the on Kim's show. And we'll give a whole show to this topic if you want. because I love talking about it. And I have, I've got facts, but I've got results from lots of different ways of eating. Vegetarian, and now this, and I'm monitoring everything. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. Hey, JW, great conversation. I love that topic, but that's why we started the podcast, so that we don't take too much time away from the trucking-related show here. So I'd love to have you on the podcast, Destination Health, and we could certainly talk about this, because there's still a lot of variables. There's no real consensus among anybody. And I am to the point that I'm just going to start doing what works. I'm going to listen to my body. And that's what I've been doing for several months now. But not only listening to my body and the way it feels, but I am going in once a quarter for blood work, for blood pressure. In fact, I'm getting a blood pressure monitor, but all my numbers are getting better. My blood pressure is down. My resting heart rate is excellent. My cholesterol is down, but I really don't care, because I don't think cholesterol is the issue that we thought it was. And there's tons of evidence to show that. Now, you know, here's another thing. If somebody already has heart disease of some sort, that may change everything. I don't know. As far as I know, I don't have any. I don't have a history of it in my family, and my cholesterol's good. And so you do have to be careful. I am also, with the fermented vegetables, consuming a tremendous amount of salt, probably 3 to 4 times the recommended amount. But my blood pressure is low, and that's the only negative consequence. There's new research that says it's not salt anyway. It's sugar that raises your blood pressure and processed foods. A lot of confusion. But if you're interested in this topic, join us on Fridays for Destination Health. Kim does an excellent job on this, and she lets me join her, and I get a little excited sometimes. Let's go to Texas. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you. I just had a quick fuel mileage question for you. I'm in a 2015 Freightliner Evolution. Got a DD15, 341 gears, and 4x4s. On my 30-day average, I'm averaging about 7.28 miles a gallon. Everything's stocked in it, no upgrades. And I just thought that maybe, as it is, I should be getting a little bit better fuel mileage. Usually average about 57-58 miles an hour.
You should. If everything works right, and you said it's an evolution, and there's no real upgrades. The thing about the evolution is, Freightliner did all the upgrades, not all of them, but Freightliner did a lot. I mean, that truck was designed for fuel economy, and driving it at 57, you're right. It should be in a half mile truck, mile per gallon truck. I know some that are doing better than 9. Here's the big problem. And this is what I've said 1,000 times, and I'm sure I'm going to say it 10,000 more. This is why I can't deal with emission trucks, and I won't deal with emission trucks. Because nothing is consistent. Some of these trucks get 9 miles to the gallon. Some of them get 6. And nobody knows why. And nobody can seem to fix them when they get 6. And I can't. I've tried. I don't know what to do with these things. I don't even like to tell people to modify them, because we've seen where upgrades just don't seem to do much good. The problem is somewhere in the emission system, in the electronics, in the sensors, in something, I don't know, we can't figure it out. And it's kind of, if all we had on the road right now were emission trucks, I'd probably quit my show, because I wouldn't be doing anybody any good. Luckily, we have lots and lots of pre-emission trucks still out there, and we can work on those and get good fuel economy out of them just about any time we want. So I wish I had an answer for you, but this is a very, very common problem with, and I'm not just picking on the Cascadia or the Evolution. This is every make and model and every engine. They are just not consistent.
Do you think the winter blended fuel has anything to do with that?
Well, not only the winter blended fuel, but all the winter conditions clearly will affect fuel economy. Now, how long have you had this truck?
I've had it since the last week of December.
So you've never owned this truck in the summertime then. Tell me about some of the, where have you been spending your time and what have the conditions been like?
I drive all 48. And here the past 3 weeks, I've been running I-10 a lot from California to Florida, then to Texas, back to Mississippi, back to Texas. And I'm averaging mid to low 7.
Okay, so you really don't even have winter blend fuel down there. There's actually a map you can go find that shows you the winter blends by region. And the farther north you go, the more extreme the blend becomes. That makes sense because the temperature gets colder. Most of the time on I-10, we don't need any winter blend at all. I mean, those are just average temperatures that any fuel will work down there. So, and you're not hitting any real winter conditions down there either. Not in the last 3 weeks, I don't think. Have you?
Just some of the ice through Texas.
Yeah. So no, if you were telling me, well, I spend most of my time up on 90 and 94 and, you know, then I'd say, well, summertime, we could expect another mile per gallon, but I don't think you're going to see any real increase in the summertime. You're already in about the best fuel mileage conditions there are. You know, cooler, low humidity. Those are good fuel mileage conditions, and you really don't have winter blend to speak of. So this, you know, these trucks are just very inconsistent. Here's another thing. I've seen them come out of the factory getting 9 miles to the gallon, and 6 months later, they're getting 6.5, and nobody knows why. And nobody knows how to fix them.
So you think putting a clean air filter system on this would give me at least a half a mile better?
I would never predict that. I would recommend putting a fleet air filter on it because it will breathe better, and that's always a good thing for a diesel. But again, these engines are so inconsistent that I am very careful to recommend anything when somebody is having a fuel mileage problem, because there's a good chance that you may not see a gain at all. You may put it on and something else funky goes wrong and, you know, we don't get the gain. And then I really, really wish I had a better answer on these trucks, but I don't. So my answer still has to be, if you are really concerned about fuel mileage and cost, I can't risk owning one of these.
Right. Because I was in a 2012 Cascadia, and honestly, it was good. And it was a 9-speed. Everything else was basically the same. Well, it was super singles. I'm running duals on this with 22.5. Fuel mileage was the same with the 2012, and that's the reason why I came to the Evolution, because I heard everybody saying, well, I'm good. 9 and 10 miles a gallon, and I just haven't seen it.
Well, the other thing you have to do is you have to be very, and I'm not saying they're lying, because there are Evolutions getting 9 miles to the gallon. There are some getting 8.5. They're out there. You have to be careful who you listen to, though. Some guys are giving you the number off their dash. Some guys are giving you the number off their IFTA report. Some guys are guessing. Some guys are just bullshitting. Sometimes here on the show, we talk about fuel mileage off the dash and off the scan gauge, but that's just for comparative purposes while we're driving. You will never hear me say a truck gets, you know, 8.8 miles to the gallon because that's what we're reading on the scan gauge or off the dash. We always calculate by miles and gallons, but there's lots and lots of people running around saying all kinds of things about fuel economy. Let's head off to Indiana. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, we're looking at an oil sample.
All right, let's see what we've got. Tell me a little bit about the truck while I'm looking this up.
Okay, had an oil cooler problem. We had that fixed, and this is the oil sample after I had it fixed. And had my truck in the shop last Friday, and they said it wouldn't start. And I said, that's not good. I got the Maxwell. Well, I got down there. The starter post had broken off, and I called customer support at Maxwell, talked to Jim, and this was last Friday. He overnighted the starter module to me and then walked me through the install and tested it, and it was excellent customer support.
Fantastic. Love to hear that. So let's take a look at this sample here. Looks like we're just over 900,000 on the engine and about 33,000 on the oil. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. So the good news is, even though the music's playing, I can wrap this one up in about 15 seconds. You don't have anything going wrong in this sample. Fuel dilution is non-existent. Soot is non-existent. Viscosity is perfect. Base is holding up nice. No oxidation, no nitration. Wear metals are all low. Little bit of potassium, but that's probably just an environmental contaminant because there's no real sodium. So you are good on this one. Just keep doing what you're doing. That engine's doing well. It's the same thing. We'll be right back. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment, so I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. Let's head back to, let's go to Nevada. Jesse, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How are you today?
Good. What's on your mind?
I have a question about gear ratios and fuel mileage, but first I wanted to tell you about I listened to your show quite a bit, and back in December 2013, I was 360 pounds, and I listened to your episode. You were talking about resolutions and how they tend to be too general and too vague, and how it's important to turn those into goals and be specific. Well, I took that to heart, and I'm today 230 pounds, so I've lost about 130 pounds, and a lot of it is just making little changes along the way, and the big one was giving up soda. I don't drink any calories at all.
You know, I'm there now, and I feel like sometimes when I mention that, it sounds so extreme. But doing the research, one can of soda, and it's more fructose than you should have in the whole day in just one can. So I'm the same way. I don't drink really any calories anymore at all. Everything other than water is optional. So that's all I want people to think about. You don't have to quit. You drink whatever you want, but just realize when it's your health or your life, everything other than water is just an option. You can live just fine on water. And I'm pretty darn happy on water, but that is amazing. Congratulations. You lost a whole person.
I know.
why.
And the big thing was, for a lot of years, I used the truck as an excuse. You know, I can't do this. I can't eat right. I can't exercise because I'm busy. I'm in a truck. I figured out how to make the truck an advantage. I don't have the distractions of, you know, let's go out to eat, or we're cooking this, or mom telling me I cooked all this food. You got to eat something, you know.
That's right.
I don't have all those distractions anymore. You know, what's in the truck? I've got it set up the way I want, and
I love
cooking the truck quite a bit. And it's been great.
I love that. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. My question for you is: I'm a heavy haul driver. And, I used to be, not so much anymore. But
that's right.
But the truck I have, I've got a Kenworth 18-speed, 550 Cummins, a true 550, and it's got 336 gears in it. And my fuel mileage, well, my 30-day is 5.09 on scan gauge or on fuel gauges.
Okay.
I know that's hanging fruit, which you always talk about, but I'm thinking about gear ratios and still having good drivability. You know, I was thinking of going to 355s, but then again, 279s you talk about kind of tweak my interest too. I'd like your opinion.
Well, yeah, there's a couple things we have to look at here. The 336s, I think, are probably about the worst gear ratio I could think of putting in that truck with what you do.
Oh, Lord, yeah.
Give me some idea of your average weight and your heaviest weight.
My average weight is probably 85,000, and my heaviest is 114.
Okay. So to give us the most flexibility in speed, see, if we go to, let's talk about going to 279s for just a second. If we do that, and you were to run that truck in direct, which is 16th gear, it would be the same ratio to the ground virtually as having 370s with your 18th speed. So when you're in 18th gear, it would be like having 370s. Now, that would be a huge improvement in pulling power over 336s. That's a big jump. And that's actually what you need. So on that, in that sense, this makes a lot of sense because you're going to be in direct, which means you lose less power. See, anytime we go to overdrive, we're at a mechanical disadvantage. We are robbing the engine of power, and you need it. I mean, you're pulling a lot of weight. You need all the power you can get. We want to be in direct. But if all we have is direct, if we match that somehow to a true direct drive transmission, then you'd be limited on speed. You know, if you got above 62 or so, you'd really start to see fuel mileage drop off. So the challenge is, how do we get direct, the right gear ratio, still have flexibility and speed? We can do that with the 279s. I have one concern, and that is the startability. So do you have to pull that kind of weight out of holes very often, or are we mostly talking about, you know, loading on pretty level ground and not coming out of, you know, steep docks or something like that?
Probably half my loads happen inside of gravel, mud, some pretty rough terrain sometimes.
So yeah, see, that
would be a concern for me.
That worries me some. It's not to say we couldn't do it. What I would do, there's actually a way to calculate startability, and you can find the formula online. And the, I could actually do it for you right now, but the problem is I don't have your first gear ratio. I have there are different gear ratios on some of the 18 speeds, and we need that number, and we could calculate startability if we know that, you know, like if we had a 15 speed with that really, really low gear, I wouldn't worry about it at all. The 18 speed, some of those first gears aren't that low, and we would run into some startability issues. And that's where you're going to have to, I would say, calculate it. I might even try to get a hold of an engineer at whoever makes your truck, or really anybody in gearing, and run it by them and calculate it. You know, if it were me, because it's what I do, I would probably try it. You know, what happens is it ends up being really hard on your clutch. I mean, you'll get the thing moving. Right. It's just hard on the clutch. And we don't want to do that unnecessarily. So I would be the guy that would be out there experimenting and seeing what happened. And if it was that horrible, I guess I'd go back. But that could get expensive. I don't want to recommend that lightly. But that, if we can overcome the startability, then that is clearly the best. Your fuel economy is going to go up. You're going to love driving the truck this way. You're going to have flexibility and speed. It's just that if we can overcome that startability issue. So that's something for you to think about and calculate. Otherwise, I would say that you would still see a pretty significant improvement if you went to 355s.
Okay. Well, I sure appreciate it. Now, here's another thought.
What is the fastest you ever need to go?
Well, my average speed's about 57. So, you know, sometimes I'll bump it up to about 62, but that's rare.
Okay. So let me change that then. If you don't go with the 279s, I would go with 370s.
Okay.
Those 370s will run up 65, even with the 370s, wouldn't be a problem. You know, I would run it all day. It still wouldn't hurt anything. If it turns out that the 279 sound a little too risky or the numbers don't work as well as we'd like, then I would put 370s in it.
Okay. Find those calculations or talk to someone at Eaton or Kenworth.
Eaton actually is the place. It's somewhere on Eaton's website where I found the calculator for startability. It's just always hard to find, and I need to go back and bookmark it. I just haven't used it in a long time. But if you can get a hold of an Eaton engineer, that could really help. They can give you some answers as well, but you can go calculate it. Let's see, how are we doing on time here? We've got time. Let's go to Florida. Dan, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Kevin?
Good. What's on your mind today?
A couple of questions. One, I got a comment about 6-volt batteries. We've talked in the past. I live on a sailboat, and I use the Trojan T105 golf cart batteries for a house bank. Okay.
Yeah.
They are fantastic. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, the RV world, and obviously there's a lot of crossover between RV and boat and that kind of thing. They've always used 6-volt batteries for the house batteries. What's the reason? I keep meaning to go talk to somebody about that because I don't understand. Why are they better?
Well, they have, for one thing, they got more lead in them. You know, when you're talking about a conventional wet cell deep cycle battery, you know, the more lead you're going to get them. But the batteries are designed to be discharged over all day long on a golf cart and then rapidly recharged and then discharged over a long period of time again. So the batteries, unintentionally, were perfectly designed for a house bank. Now, you're not going to be starting off of them. You don't have the ability of, like, the starting power, but they will run a lower amperage draw over an extended period of time without any issues at all.
The music's playing. I know you had another question. Hold on. I'm going to come back to you. The show's over, but I'm going to come back and get this because I screwed up my time. I was looking at the wrong clock. I've got to get out of here. I am out of time. It just flies by when you're having fun. I'll see you back here next time. Thanks for joining me. Be safe. Be profitable, do the hard work, and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford.
Thanks for tuning in to The Audio Road. If you have any questions, give us a call at 855-800-FUEL. That's 855-800-3835. Check out the website at letstruck.com and find us on facebook.com/letstruck.